our approach to this, to our relaunch, first and foremost, make certain that the environment is as safe as it can possibly be, and that folks are able to enjoy the museum and be comfortable and not have to worry.
I am on the prowl indeed. Welcome to Podcats. This is Cats, John Katsalamidis of the Las Vegas Review Journal. My column is called Cats, fittingly enough. Find it on page 3A every day and online all the time. My guest this week is the man behind the mob in Las Vegas, the Mob Museum president and CEO, Jonathan Ullman. Jonathan outlines the museum's plans for reopening during COVID-19, describes some of his favorite exhibits, and retraces its history in the former federal courthouse in downtown Las Vegas, where we do this interview.
Jonathan Ullman, it's always a pleasure to see you, sir.
Yeah, it's great to see you.
So what's new?
Everything's new, Katz.
I've talked to you in many forums, but never quite in this context before. So
this is different.
It's definitely different. Well, I know it's a different time for all of us, so I appreciate you taking time to talk to us here. Let's just go through some of the protocols and what people can expect when they come down to the Mob Museum now.
Sure. Well, probably the most obvious one is the masks, adorning our faces as we speak.
Product placement.
That's right.
In my case,
you never miss an opportunity for that.
I think I might start leasing my face for product placement.
I can see that. Yeah. I can see that.
Little side gig.
But yeah, we our approach to this to our relaunch, first and foremost, make certain that the environment is as safe as it can possibly be, and that folks are able to enjoy the museum and be comfortable and not have to worry. Mm-hmm. So we've instituted a number of new policies and other safety measures. So when you go through the museum, it will be the same great Mob Museum experience that you've had before.
Right.
It's going to be fantastic. But you will notice that we have spaced some exhibits farther apart.
Right.
We've modified interactives. In some cases, I think you'll find improvements that we're fortunate that we've come across.
What's one of those?
Kind of byproducts of, well, as you see some of the videos that we in the adjacent rooms, that the seating is now more comfortable, they're more open, you can see the videos and hear them better, the layout is stronger. We're going to have new artifacts on display.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually working on what I think will be the absolute best ticket queuing space in Las Vegas. It's not quite done yet, but we want to make certain that people don't have to wait outside in the heat to get into the museum, because now we're going to be pulsing people through at a more measured pace, mm-hmm. so it doesn't get crowded.
Everybody 6 feet apart, but the line fluid.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. We'll be strongly encouraging time ticketing. And so we've commandeered some space on the first floor so that we can queue people up. But in that space, even before you get a ticket, there'll be new exhibits on display. So we've got this whole pop culture and the mob theme going on down there. So it's part of a new campaign that we'll be releasing
soon. Well,
let's
talk about some of the new stuff then. So
sure.
You touched on it already. What are some of the new attractions new exhibits that we can see at the attractions?
Well, the first thing I want to mention that's not quite a new exhibit, but a new attraction and something that also ties back into our new safety measures is our hand sanitizer.
Okay.
That we are producing right down in our distillery in the underground. So if you can see these various accoutrements that we have here.
Accoutrement.
This bottle, everything in this bottle has been manufactured on site. So you can come in, and when you go through our wellness queue, so you'll be spaced 6 feet apart, your party, distance from other mm-hmm. parties. You'll go through a wellness check. So we do take temperatures.
Yes. Did that today.
Mm-hmm. We do. How'd you do?
I passed. I'm sitting
good.
Here. So
good. So we do that. But you also, so if you don't bring your own mask, we will provide you with a complimentary mask. We will also have some nice design masks that are available as a souvenir that you can purchase if you like. But you also, with your ticket, you get a complimentary 1 ounce bottle of house-made hand sanitizer.
And this is indeed made here.
This is
on site.
Yes.
With your own still.
Yes. So we that's a lengthy process. So you have to run the liquid through the still several times to get it to a high enough proof, because this is 80% ethanol.
Yeah, I see that.
So I think the manufacturing process may need some tweaking over time for us to handle the volume.
80 proof hand sanitizer.
You got this 80% ethanol hand sanitizer.
Yeah.
You should open it up, give it a feel.
I said this on Twitter that there was a time in my life when this type of thing qualified as a beverage.
Yeah, well, this stuff is denatured.
So it's liquefied.
We follow the FDA process that is a very simple.
Ooh, hello.
Very simple, yeah, okay. Yeah. Only 4 ingredients in that, but it does have a scent that is quite reminiscent of the moonshine. So it might.
So the ingredients in hand sanitizer like this and in moonshine are pretty close, in other words, right?
You cannot consume this, though. So do not.
Watch me.
Do not mistake it for.
No, I wouldn't.
What was that? Banaka? Was that the thing back in the day?
Banaka, yeah.
All the cool kids.
I'm going to the Desert Inn during the Dan Tana days when I do that. All right. Well, that's cool. You guys have adapted, I'll tell you, you know?
Well, I mean, you got to. I mean, we have to, you know, we were very careful to listen to what our members had to say.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, you know, understanding the other research, you know, regarding the overall marketplace. And we know that safety is foremost on people's minds, and we got to be responsible too. So,
yeah.
But I'm really proud of how the team has responded, because I think we've instituted all the right safety precautions and even things that you can't see. I mean, from the filtration system in the HVAC,
right?
You know, the amount of turnover of air in the building, the deep cleaning that we do after hours. I mean, it's and the amount of touching that you have to do when you go through the museum. That maybe sounds kind of odd the way in which I started saying that, but we've had interactives. Like if you go down on the first floor, we have this great wiretap exhibit.
Yes.
You can go up to it and you can listen to, you know, wiretap recordings of John Gotti, for example, and you know that was used as evidence in prosecuting Gotti. You used to have to find the button and put on the headphones. Now you wave in front of the little sensor. You don't have to touch anything. It comes at a, you know, there's a speaker above you now. So I think it's going to be an easier, more comfortable experience. It's going to be the same amount of fun it used to be, and I think people are going to be really, really comfortable.
You have that exhibit up there that's an electric chair, too.
That's
right. Is it still part of this? Is it still part
so
of
you
the can you still do that?
Well, you can. So you picked a tricky one there, Katz.
That's what I thought of it, yeah, because I've been in that.
Because you can sit on that, but we have disabled the handle, because the new directives are that for hands-on interactives, and that's one that, you know, we can't make some other modification to it. So unfortunately, you won't be able to have the full electric chair experience, but you can have
You'll
a
get
lot
a late
of that
pardon,
experience.
A really late pardon from the electric
that's right.
chair. That's,
that's
you
right.
build that in. what should happen for this period to be successful to you? Let me ask you it that way. That these things must happen so you can get through this period and be okay with it. Maybe list or a pointed, like a bullet point.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's a great question. I mean, first and foremost, we have to have guests come back, have a great time, and tell other people that not only is the experience a wonderful experience, which we're confident it will be, but also that they felt really comfortable, really safe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's absolutely critical. I think, you know, for the overall marketplace, you know, that's, you know, it's not really dissimilar to what we need to do for the larger kind of Las Vegas community.
Right.
We need to, you know, right now, I think we're all working with some amount of research,
mm-hmm.
you know, some amount of data, but also a lot of uncertainty and a lot of, you know, to some degree, flying by the seat of our pants. And I think we know And we've seen this. We've seen it in other parts of the country. We've also seen it in, you know, the phase one reopenings, that there absolutely is pent-up demand. I mean, there are some people that want to get back out there.
Yes.
That are maybe, you know, are not risk averse. You know, they've been sitting home. They want to get it back out. They want to have fun. Mm-hmm. And I'm not really concerned about, you know, those folks. But there's, you know, there's a whole nother segment of the marketplace, of the consumer, that are waiting and, you know, have more of a wait and see attitude.
From where is your demographic, aside from Las Vegas residents, where do they come from normally?
So on a tip, you know, if you were asking this question, 2019, we're typically between 85-90% non-local, so tourists. So 2019, we did over 400,000 people. Only, you know, 10-12% of them were local community.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Most of the visitors are domestic. We do have, approximately, 5%, international visitors, who tend to come mostly from, of the international, UK, Australia,
okay.
Canada, Mexico, of course, is also important. And then, we've certainly had visitors from, over 35 countries, over time. Mm-hmm. But the vast majority of the visitors are domestic travelers. Southern California is huge. I mean, that is, and I think right now it's more important than ever, for us, as we're all, somewhat concerned about people's appetite for getting back on airplanes.
Yeah.
That the drive-in market, it's the Southern California, it's the Phoenix area, that's where the focus is going to shift early on.
Right. We're in a famous room here. We might as well describe the Kefauver room here.
Well, that's right.
Where we
that's
are. Right. It's just so people know before I lose track of that. This is a legendary room inside a famous building. Describe
the
significance of this.
I forgot myself for a moment there that this is...
It's easy to do, yeah.
So this space is, this whole building is a treasure for Las Vegas. It's the historic former post office and federal courthouse. So the whole building, by Las Vegas standards, very old. It was put in service in 1933. It's on the National Registry of Historic Places. It's nationally significant historically. That's not just because of the architecture. I mean, you can see, the architecture in here, it is beautiful. And on the outside, I'm not quite certain that you can get a better example in Las Vegas of Depression era neoclassical architecture than this uh-huh. building. But this room, as you point out, Katz, this room is pretty important to our history. So November 15th, 1950, this was one of the locations of what were known as the Kefauver Committee hearings. So that was a series of U.S. Senate investigative hearings into organized crime.
Mm-hmm.
They were known as Kefauver Committee hearings because the chair was Estes Kefauver, who was the senator out of Tennessee, very ambitious man, would later go on to run for president, unsuccessfully, of course. But those committee investigations during the course of 1950 and 1951 took place in 14 cities across the country, one of those cities being here in Las Vegas. So back on that day, people like Mo Sedway, who was managing the Flamingo,
right?
Wilbur Clark, who was the front man of the Desert Inn, testified in front of the committee. And the committee was all about rooting out organized crime. And another really interesting piece of all this is that this was a national phenomenon at the time, because never before, people may have read about various mob, figures, kingpins like Frank Costello, for example.
Yeah.
But they never really got to see him live. And these hearings, not all of them, but about half of the hearings were televised. And this was the first time that ever happened with Senate investigative hearings. So you think about some of the hearings that we've had of late, where the world kind of stops as people gather around the TV to see what's going to happen.
This was every TV in the country was tuned into these hearings.
I mean, they estimate that it was, you know, 20 to 30 million Americans back then, and only about half the households had television. Mm-hmm. So people would go where they could. So schools and businesses might close when mm-hmm. the hearings were on, and people would gather, whether it was at somebody's house or in a department store, you know, to see what was going to happen. And, you know, another piece of this that's so important for Las Vegas and the way things unfolded here is that back in that time, early 1950s, gambling was legal in Las Vegas,
mm-hmm.
wasn't legal anywhere else. But there were other parts of the country where it was happening, and the powers that be, so to speak, were just turning a blind eye to it. And in fact, some other states were even contemplating legalizing gambling.
Right.
So when people saw the corruption and they saw these very seedy characters.
And there were human beings who were making it, who were enacting it. That was the crazy
so
thing.
So there was this severe backlash. And as we know, it wasn't until late 70s that gaming came online in Atlantic City. So if you think about how, you know, if those hearings didn't take place, you know, maybe things would have still gone down the same path, but maybe they wouldn't. And maybe Las Vegas wouldn't have been the only game in town for another mm-hmm. 25 plus years.
Yeah, it's a very it's really interesting. And the Mob Museum, I remember when the plans were initially made public for the Mob Museum down here in this building, there was a great deal of debate, of course, about glamorizing the mob and making it too, you know, putting it on too high a pedestal and kind of fictionalizing it and viewing it through a different kind of entertainment media type prism rather than reality. And you were around in those times. Do you think you've successfully made the divide and put the mob legacy in its proper place in this museum now that we're,
you know,
a few years on?
So, I mean, that's a great question, Katz. And I will always, I will never claim perfection. I will never say that. You know, we can always do better. And I think that's part of the secret to our success is we're always trying to do better at mm-hmm. everything we can do. But I think in this regard, we really did do a very good job. I mean, if you remember back before we opened, you know, there was a lot of concern. You read the paper, you know, that this was somehow going to be, you know, a shrine to the mob. It was going to glorify the mob.
Right.
And I think, you know, understandably, a lot of folks in the community didn't really know what to expect. You know, the we knew mm-hmm. what we were building, but it's, you know, hard to impart that on the general public. So can kind of understand the apprehension there. But I think we've been extremely balanced. I mean, you know, part of this comes from the fact that you don't need to romanticize or glamorize or in any way embellish these stories for them to be interesting to people.
Right.
I mean, the stories just on their own.
A straight recitation of the history. Right?
Fascinating. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we try to strike the right balance so we let people have fun. I mean, a lot of the visitors that come through here, they've seen the mob movies. You know, they have quotes, you know, that they like to, mm-hmm. from the movies they like to express and they like to, you know, have a little fun. We all like to have a little fun mm-hmm. with, you know, our various, you know, mob references and puns and such. But at the end of the day, we're just, you know, it's storytelling. Mm-hmm. And it's storytelling about factual occurrences that are just, you know, fascinating.
It was modeled in some ways. I remember that when it was first developed, there was a lot of correspondence with the folks and input from folks who run like the Spy Museum and like facilities like that. And it feels like more like the Sixth Floor Museum in Dallas, maybe that type of vibe. It seems to be more in that vein than a pure entertainment attraction, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the original designers, same people that did the International Spy Museum, mm-hmm. that did the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I think that we, and I also want to say, I mean, as wonderful a job they did, we have a pretty incredible crew on staff who do, you know, exhibit work and have made, you know, incredible refinements over the years. I mean, mm-hmm. If you walk through the museum that opened in 2012 and you walk through the museum now, you know, there are significant parts of this that have changed dramatically. And then, of course, also the programming piece that has been so huge, you know, the panel discussions mm-hmm. And presentations we've done in this room and that we now also do digitally, are a whole nother way in which we're able to tell the story. And I think to your question of how do you get around, how do you take care that you're not glorifying or romanticizing, when you think about what we offer, the exhibits and the programs and kind of the whole portfolio, you know, there's a really nice balance between, you know, topics that are fascinating, not as educationally enriching or important as others, but then also some very, very heavy, you know, deep topics. And you can't, you know, you have to think about the whole package. I mean, you can't just be feeding people, you know, history lessons and other, you know, social commentary that is, it can't be work to go through a museum. You want it to be enriching. Mm-hmm. You want it to be, you know, culturally enlightening, but it also has to be fun.
Learn without really realizing you're learning.
Yeah.
Read without realizing you're reading it. Yeah. There was I think people, might not remember, those of us who were around about a decade ago, remember the other attraction. There was a thing called the Mob Experience.
Yes.
That was going into the Trop,
yes,
which is more in line with a pure entertainment attraction. Yeah. And they were coming online at about the same time, this one and that one.
They actually, you know, Cats, they beat us to market by a few months.
Mm-hmm. And they did open first.
Fairly outrageous. You know, I'm not originally from here. You know, I come from the East Coast, my background is in museums, and it was fairly, you know, flabbergasting to me that a community that's put as much into an actual historic restoration in this building, mm-hmm, and all of the resources to create, you know, a museum that would be not just a world-class museum, but also a wonderful gathering place for the community, that you would have to deal with some, you know, some other entity that was, you know, hey, that sounds like a good idea. Let me see if we can get out there first and win.
It was,
it's a for-profit entity. I mean, this is, where does that happen?
It was Mob in theme, but after that, there was hardly anything in common with these places.
No. But that was, those were some times, man.
Yeah,
back in 2012, you know, mm-hmm, that was a rough road getting started and dealing with that.
What's been the biggest challenge in your tenure here, really, with the Mob Museum? Has it been trying to change people's attitude toward what they perceive as the Mob? What do you think has been the biggest hurdle?
I think it's, I think challenge-wise, it's trying to do all the things that we think that we can do that are really worthwhile and meaningful. And, you know, you're in a marketplace that is very tourist dependent,
mm-hmm,
that isn't necessarily, you know, the first reason why people are coming to Las Vegas isn't necessarily to go visit a museum. You know, it's, mm-hmm, they've done studies of, you know, cultural tourism. And I think we have come a long way as a community, and we have, you know, wonderfully rich, you know, institutions here. But there's a lot of noise.
Yeah.
And, you know, for a lot of the tourists, they're not coming with museums on their mind first and foremost. So trying to penetrate and make certain that the tourists are aware that we're here, and to make certain that the tourists, I'm talking back when we first opened,
right,
was quite a challenge. You know, mm-hmm, so I would never say that everybody knows of us now, but we have a great deal more brand awareness nationally. The tourist that is coming to Las Vegas now,
right,
you know, there is a lot of, you know, higher name recognition there. But early on, making folks aware of us, and I think trying to walk that line where you have messaging that is directed at the tourists and lets them know that this is, a wonderful, enriching experience, but also very fun and fits in, you know, just fine with your Las Vegas, is a great enhancement to your Las Vegas vacation.
Mm-hmm.
But then also trying to do many of the other things that kind of fly beneath the radar. You know, a lot of folks don't know how successful our educational outreach has been to various schools in the Clark County School District. You know,
right,
the things that we do, you know, we've send educators out into vans, go primarily to Title I schools, do presentations about Nevada history, Las Vegas history, constitutional law. We do senior outreach. We have programs, that we've done on site that, about some pretty heavy topics. So they're not always, mob history and law enforcement history, but, the things that are extremely important to us today in society, like use of force, for example.
Yes.
That's
the art of
again,
the practice of surveillance.
Yes.
Surveilling somebody. So it's something you could, Mm-hmm.
So generating awareness about that kind of, the breadth and diversity of what we do and making certain that we give the right attention to all those parts is something that I think is an ongoing, challenge. I mean, you just always, trying to do as much as you can and strike the right balance.
Your own background, you mentioned, is not in the mob culture as a historian necessarily that way. No. What were you doing?
I do come from New Jersey originally.
Okay.
So there's
you're the minority there. Is that it? Did you work in the sanitation industry? But what were you doing before you got to the mob museum?
Yeah. So my background's museums. Immediately before I was here, I was at the National Soccer Hall of Fame and Museum. Before that, I had spent a great deal of time at an interactive science center in North Jersey. Mm-hmm. So Liberty Science Center, which is a wonderful institution. Again, very, that's much more of a regional venue and, student and family oriented as opposed to a tourist destination like this is.
Yeah. And do you have now that you've had a period of time here, some favorite exhibits, some that you that come to mind that's, two or three that you really like, that are your personal favorites?
Oh my gosh. I mean, this is, so... That's like asking me, which of my three children are my favorite.
I thought of that right as I said it, but there has to be some place to.
I think the so it's hard to not start with the courtroom, of course. The wall on the third floor that from the warehouse where the St. Valentine's Day massacre took place, and I think that what's amazing about that exhibit. It's not just that we have the wall, it's that we have all the ballistics evidence that from that crime. I mean, it's one of the most famous crimes that have ever taken place in history. I'm not just talking about mob-related crimes. It is, and you have all the ballistics evidence. Getting back to, I think, my science roots, I kind of enjoy that too, because it's was a seminal moment in ballistic science and forensic science where, one of the first cases where, as in this particular case, the crime took place in Chicago. There was a lot of concern about it potentially being an inside job. Some of the witnesses that saw the men go into the warehouse, reported that they were wearing police uniforms. So local business, community leaders went and got Calvin Goddard, who was a scientist in New York, to come out and work the investigation. And he's considered to be the father of ballistics research. One of the first cases where he would take a compound microscope and compare test bullets. So as you see, like now if you watch a crime show and you see, they shoot a bullet into a vat of gel or something, recover the bullet and compare the striations. Back then they would shoot the bullet into a waste basket full of cotton, and retrieve the test bullet and compare it to bullets found at the scene of the crime. And it was one of the first cases where they used that
really
science and actually found a weapon that was traced back to that crime. So I think, that whole compilation we put together upstairs is certainly fascinating to me.
Yeah.
But I love the new experiences that we came out with when we renovated beginning in 2018 and we came out with the crime lab. So now you can go in there and you can experience the interactives. You can actually try to do some matching of bullets, on the microscopes or do DNA profiling or fingerprint analysis. There's this amazing digital autopsy table. Love that space. I love the whole use of force area and the firearm training simulator. I mean, where else can you go and really get a sense of what it must be like to be a law enforcement officer.
Oh, you can spend a long time in this museum. Oh. Yeah, you can. You get lost in here. I've sent my family. My family's been here, you know, when they come to town. It's a great place if you've seen some of Las Vegas. But my parents and I've had aunts and uncles come down here, and it takes a long time to fish them out. You know, they love it. It's a great, I think, you know, when you talk about most of your, most of your guests are from elsewhere, 80% or whatever it is. I think people who live here drive a lot of traffic for those people.
Oh, absolutely.
There, you know,
we've always had a very soft spot, you know, for locals. I mean, the local ticket price is like 40% of what we charge to the tourists. We do a lot of free programming. Mm-hmm. So we do, not only have we done our 2 days a year, our anniversary and our, you know, Kiefhofer anniversary
right.
day is completely free to the public, but we also offer community safety forums where once a month in here on a weekend afternoon, we would have members of law enforcement come in and present on a topic that is, you know, beneficial to the locals.
Right.
And if somebody wants to come to that, they can come for free. You know, this was sponsored. I got to give credit to NV Energy for sponsoring that,
sure.
but makes it sort of, you know, something that is not just a valuable resource, but also enables people to visit the museum for free. So we're always looking for opportunities like that. And part of it is, you know, to your point, you know, I don't want it to sound like it's self-serving, but it is, it comes back to us. Because whenever sure. you bring somebody through here, you know, they end up telling other people, or when family comes to town, you know, hey, we got to go down there and check out the speakeasy, or we got to go down there and check out the courtroom.
I hear that a lot, you know, from my friends who live in Las Vegas, that they've sent their families here, or they've even come with their families, whichever way it works. And I also want to ask you about the kind of the pure entertainment element of this downstairs in the underground, which I've always really liked down there. It's a very cool little hang. What is the future, and I've written a little bit about this,
yeah.
what is the future of that enclave down there? We've got the distillery, we've got the underground speakeasy, all that entertainment fortress.
Right.
What's going to happen with that?
Well, it's not gone. First mm-hmm. of all, I say that. I mean, the base experience is still as good as it's ever been. And I think it's, I'm really proud of what we created down there, because it is a working distillery where we make moonshine.
Mm-hmm.
It is a speakeasy exhibit space that is an actual speakeasy.
Mm-hmm.
So when you go in there, I mean, you can get an amazing drink, and we have, you know, extremely talented staff, you know, the bartenders back there,
mm-hmm.
not only will they make you a drink, but they'll tell you a story about the drink. You know, sometimes they do their, you know, their cocktail camera demonstrations where, you know, there's monitors behind the bar, and they'll, you know, they got the camera set up, so they'll explain the history of the cocktail while they're showing you how it's made.
Mm-hmm.
There's exhibits right in the bar and all around, so you can see, you know, whether it's the cases that have the flapper dresses or the props from you know, mob movie, or the panels that talk about what that era was like and
right.
all the wonderful imagery. All of that is still there. And I think the menu still is wonderful. You know, we're not, for a while, we're not going to be handing out the menus that you used to get,
right.
which were like these, you know,
mm-hmm.
it was a tome. I mean, it was a...
Yeah, it was part of the experience. Yeah.
You know,
the menu itself.
Mm-hmm. You know, it was like a storybook.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll still get, you know, to select your cocktails, and you'll get a story behind them. I think the challenge is, you know, until we can bring back, you know, more people into the space at a time, and until we can have live performers in a space, you know, that is of that, you know, that works for that size, we're going to have to find other ways to entertain. So, you know, whether that's maybe not having the three-piece band for some period of time inside the speakeasy, and instead having some other type of multimedia musical, you know, presentation. I think there's opportunities there.
Mm-hmm.
We also are fortunate that, you know, we have more property than what's right inside the building. So I think there is a future for getting outside the building and being able to serve more people and doing more, you know, in the way of live music performance right. that we're not as constrained by the spaces inside. So I think, you know, we got to get the museum back open again.
Mm-hmm.
We're excited about that happening this weekend, But I think then we're immediately turning our attention to, you know, how do we bring back some of the things that we did before, but how do we create some new, you know, new ways of engaging people that are just as special,
right,
if not better?
Yeah, right, right. Well, it has, it's a lot of potential. I mean, when you talk about 400,000 people coming through here in 2019, that's
yeah.
what it was.
Yep.
You know, that's a lot. That's a lot of traction.
We were on fire, man.
I know. It'll come back.
It will.
You know, we'll all be
absolutely.
Back. We're,
I mean, that's why, you know, when I say that, I don't mean to, you know, by any means to complain. And we're in a, you know, I think we're in a very fortunate spot where we are,
mm-hmm.
That we're able to get started again and start build it back. I think, you know, when I say that, it's really the optimism and a reminder that we've gone through tough times before. I mean, Las mm-hmm. Vegas has gone through ups and downs. And, you know, we're going to come out of this and we'll get back to where we were at the beginning of the year when we were, you know, when we were firing on all cylinders.
Yeah. If anybody can figure this out, it's Las Vegas.
Absolutely.
You know that. We agree on that. It's just a matter of how and how long, you know, how long it'll take. But there's no, absolutely no doubt in my mind of our architecture, our ingenuity, it lends itself to getting out of this.
So, right on.
You know, I'm in, I'm all in, man. Yeah. Well, Jonathan, is there anything else you want to say about the reopening or what you've got
just,
going on?
Just, you know, tickets are available starting Sunday. I mean, folks want to come to the speakeasy Saturday night, Bee's Knees.
Bee's Knees.
You know, after 7.
That's a 20s term, folks.
I think, you know, I will say, you know, while we're doing a podcast and we're talking podcasts, you know, folks got to check out Mobbed Up.
Mobbed Up.
I mean, that podcast is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's
we're
great.
Really... you know, we're proud that we were able to contribute and, you know, be a resource for the creation of that. But that there's some great storytelling there. So
mm-hmm.
something great for you to listen to while you're in the car driving down to the Mob Museum.
Yeah, I know. Reed Redman, who produces podcasts, is the producer and narrator of Mobbed Up. And I know that it really affected him because earlier today he threatened to belly shoot me with a snub-nose 38, and which is new for it's new.
Yeah.
It's a new thing for
yeah.
us. So, you know, I gotta show him
with the half respect. Slugs.
All right, Jonathan, well, it's always a pleasure to see you. And mask on or off, we're going to be here for the reopening.
Thanks so much, Katz.
And all the way down the line.
Great to see you.
You
man.
Too, sir.
Thanks once more to Jonathan Ullman for joining us this week on Podcats. We'll be back next Monday and every Monday, so be sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. What is happening in the column, you might be asking yourselves? Well, the D Las Vegas owner, Derek Stevens, gave away 1,000 flights to Las Vegas on Wednesday morning. He gave away another 1,000 flights to Las Vegas on Wednesday afternoon. Find out why and how he did it in the column. LaRev at Wynn Las Vegas has furloughed its entire cast and crew until a timeline is established to return the show to the stage. About 275 employees are currently out of work, but they are receiving benefits through August 31st. Bellagio is relaunching its water show and also the Mayfair Supper Club with its stage show when casinos reopen in Las Vegas this week. The Supper Club especially will be a focal point for entertainers around town. Fremont Street Experience is returning to life at 9 a.m. Wednesday. Read how Patrick Hughes plans to encourage social distancing on the pedestrian promenade. And you can see comedy at Notoriety at Neonopolis and live music at Tommy Rockers, Tuscany Suites, Don't Tell Mama, and Bootlegger Bistro, among other places in Las Vegas. All that and more in Cats. That closes out another episode of Podcats. Thank you, Frankie Moreno, for our theme song, The Biggest Cat in Town. Keep up with me, or try to, on the Review Journal website, or at Johnny Katz on Twitter, at JohnnyKatz1 on Instagram, and tune in next Monday to the next installment of Podcats. Well, it's a jungle out there, baby, and I'm the biggest cat in town.